Our reading this morning is in the book of Esther. It's on page 507 in the books under the seats, the Bible. So it's always good to have that opened up. And it's the final two chapters. Chapter 10 is very small, so we've lumped them both together, chapter 9 and chapter 10. Remember, we're now at the place in the story of the book of Esther where the baddie, Haman, has been put to death, the servant of Satan. Has been put to death, but his evil plot to have all the Jews in the kingdom killed is still there. Now God's people have been given permission to rise up and defend themselves. And so it's the final episode in the story of Esther. And the theme is victory. And that's the whole theme that we're thinking of this morning. Now it's quite long, so let's just get down to it. On the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, the edict commanded by the king was to be carried out. On this day, the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them. But now the tables were turned, and the Jews got the upper hand over those who hated them. The Jews assembled in their cities, in all the provinces of King Xerxes, to attack those seeking their destruction. No one could stand against them, because the people of all the other nationalities were afraid of them. And all the nobles of the provinces, the satraps and governors, and the king's administrators helped the Jews, because fear of Mordecai had seized them. Mordecai was prominent in the palace. His reputation spread throughout the provinces, and he became more and more powerful. The Jews struck down all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying them, and they did what they pleased to those who hated them. In the citadel of Susa, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. They also killed the 10 sons of Haman, their names are there, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews, but they did not lay their hands on the plunder. The number of those slain in the citadel of Susa was reported to the king that same day. The king said to Queen Esther, "The Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men and the 10 sons of Haman in the citadel of Susa. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now what's your petition? It will be given you. What's your request? It will also be granted." "If it pleases the king," Esther answered, "give Jews in Susa permission to carry out this day's edict tomorrow also, and let Haman's 10 sons be hanged on gallows." So the king commanded that this be done. An edict was issued in Susa, and they hanged the 10 sons of Haman. The Jews in Susa came together on the 14th day of the month of Adar, and they put to death in Susa 300 men, but they did not lay their hands on the plunder. Meanwhile, the remainder of the Jews who were in the king's provinces also assembled to protect themselves and get relief from their enemies. They killed 75,000 of them, but didn't lay their hands on the plunder. This happened on the 13th day of the month of Adar, and on the 14th they rested and made it a day of feasting and joy. The Jews in Susa, however, had assembled on the 13th and 14th, and then on the 15th, they rested and made it a day of feasting and joy. That is why rural Jews, those living in villages, observe the 14th of the month of Adar as a day of joy and feasting, a day for giving presents to each other. Mordecai recorded these events, and he sent letters to all the Jews throughout the provinces of King Xerxes, near and far, to have them celebrate annually the 14th and 15th days of the month of Adar as the time when the Jews got relief from their enemies and as the month when their sorrow was turned into joy and their mourning into a day of celebration. He wrote them to observe the days as days of feasting and joy and giving presents of food to one another and gifts to the poor. So the Jews agreed to continue the celebration they'd begun, doing what Mordecai had written to them. For Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to destroy them and had cast the pur, that is the lot, for their ruin and destruction. But when the plot came to the king's attention, he issued written orders that the evil scheme Haman had devised against the Jews should come back on his own head, and that he and his son should be hanged on the gallows. Therefore, these days were called Purim, from the word poor. Because of everything written in this letter, and because of what they had seen and what had happened to them, the Jews took it upon themselves to establish the custom that they and their descendants and all who joined them should without fail observe these 2 days every year in the way prescribed and at the time appointed. These days should be remembered and observed in every generation, by every family, and in every province, and in every city. And these days of Purim should never cease to be celebrated by the Jews, nor should the memory of them die out amongst their descendants. So Queen Esther, daughter of Abihail, along with Mordecai the Jew, wrote with full authority, confirm the second letter concerning Purim. And Mordecai sent letters to all the Jews in the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Xerxes, words of goodwill and assurance, to establish these days of Purim at their designated times, as Mordecai the Jew and Queen Esther had decreed for them, and as they had established for themselves and their descendants in regard to their times of fasting and lamentation. Esther's decree confirmed these regulations about Purim, and it was written down in the records. King Xerxes imposed tribute throughout the empire to its distant shores, and all his acts of power and might, together with a full account of the greatness of Mordecai, to which the king had raised him, are they not written in the book of the annals of the kings of Media and Persia? Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Xerxes, preeminent among the Jews, and held in high esteem by his many fellow Jews, because he worked for the good of his people and spoke up for the welfare of all the Jews. Okay, we turn our minds to these two chapters this morning. The great plot that Satan had hatched against the people of God through his servant, Haman, had failed. Haman is now dead, his body swinging 75 feet high on the gallows he'd built outside his house to hang Mordecai the Jew on. The tables were turned. Just in a moment, everything had been changed. The archenemy of God's people was dead. The faithful servant of God, Mordecai, is now second in power in that whole empire. It's a remarkable turnaround and should encourage us concerning any situation in our own lives, in our church, or in our nation, that in a moment God can, just in a flash, turn anything round just like that. In this situation, it was all turned round. There was just one thing remaining to be done. The decree had gone out that on the 13th day of the 12th month, anybody in the kingdom could rise up and could slay any Jew in the city. A second decree had gone out to counteract that, saying that people, the Jewish people, could rise up on that day and defend themselves. So the victory that was declared when Haman was hung on the gallows now has to be claimed. It has to be worked out in the lives of God's people. And there's a direct parallel, isn't there, with what we'll celebrate shortly in the Lord's Supper. Because when Jesus died on the cross, victory was declared over sin and over our past and over our shame and over our guilt. It was declared, it's finished, he said. But it has to be claimed. It has to be worked out in our lives. We still meet temptation every day. We have to work at it. We have to win the victory over these things. So the victory is declared, but has to be claimed. That's the parable that we see in this book this morning. Victory must be won, and victory can only be won, ultimately, in Jesus. Now, if that victory is going to be won in our lives, the first thing we need to do is to recognize the hatred of our enemy. In verses 1 and 2 of this chapter, we're reminded of the hatred that the enemy had for the Jewish people. On that day, the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them, but now the tables were turned, and the Jews got the upper hand over those who hated them. We must not forget there is an enemy out there who hates us. There is an evil force. There is the devil. There is all his demonic forces out there, and he hates us. He hates God's people. He hates Jesus. He hates God. He hates the church. And if you're one of God's people this morning, he hates you. He hates me. He will do whatever he can to bring us down, to bring us under his control again. He works to wipe out every hint of God in our land and in our nation in these days. He will do anything to do Jesus down. Haman's plot had focused on the destruction of Mordecai, and then on the destruction of the people of God. And right from the opening chapters of Genesis, Satan has set his mind to destroy the people of God. Plot after plot in the Old Testament to wipe them out. Here's another plot in the book of Esther. He'll do anything he can to stop Jesus coming, because he knew that if Jesus came, the victory would not belong to himself. And so we need to recognize that there is an evil force out there that works against us in every respect. Corrie ten Boom, the famous Dutch Christian lady, said, "The first step on the way to victory is to recognize the enemy." So that's the first point this morning here. If we're going to win the victory, let's at least believe there's an enemy that we need to win that victory over. That said, in this story, it seems that the enemy must at least be given a chance to change. The second decree went out. Mordecai organized a second decree that the Jews could rise up on that day and defend themselves. That was designed to give the people time to think. Do we want to fight the Jews then? Do we want to risk our own lives? Do we want to take that on board? They were given a chance to think again. And it seems from what we're told here in this chapter, the rise of Mordecai to that high place of power had put the fear of God into people's lives. And many people were stopping and thinking, do I really want to oppose this God? Do I really want to fight against the people of God? And some of them, we discovered last week, if you remember, had begun again and decided, I want to be a Jew. I want to belong to the people of God. So they were being given this second chance. The gospel gives us a second chance, more than a second chance. Gospel gives us a chance right up to the moment we die to turn to Jesus. The thief on the cross, gasping his last gasping breath, looked at Jesus, believed, and was saved for eternity. The second chance is given to all of us. Somebody once said, I would like to build a rescue hut within a yard of hell. Wanting to save people at the last gasp. Recognize that the enemy must be given a second chance. That said, this story makes it very clear that if we are going to win the victory, claim that victory, we need to recognize that God will, of course, ultimately judge evil. If people refuse the chance, if people turn their backs on Jesus and the gospel, the only thing that remains for them is judgment. And clearly, there were still some people in that empire who decided, no, I don't want to become one of God's people. I don't want anything to do with God. In fact, I'd like to wipe them out, so I'm going to try. And so some did rise up and sought to attack God's people. They refused the offer of grace. 500 died that day in the city of Susa. The 10 sons of Haman, who clearly were of their father's ilk, they also died that day. The next day, a further 300 died. And in fact, throughout the whole empire, a further 75,000 died of the enemies of God's people. Now, folks, some folks think, oh, the Jews are bad. Imagine killing all these people. And some folks think that they struggle with what the Jews do in this story. But surely that's crazy. If somebody was coming to you with a sword and you had a knife in your pocket, you would use the knife to defend yourself, wouldn't you? Wouldn't you just say, go ahead then? Of course not. You would fight back. And put it in perspective. The population of that empire was probably about 100 million. The population of the Jewish people was probably about 2 million. So 76,000 people done to death for fighting the Jews is no such a big thing when you put it in perspective. But the message that we have to get across is if people reject the gospel, if people reject Jesus, the only thing that's left for them is death, is judgment, is hell. And that's fair. That's just. That's what sin deserves. That's what Jesus rescues us from when we put our trust in him. We deserve judgment. We deserve hell. We deserve death as sinful people. But Jesus rescues us. If we refuse that rescue, what's left? Lord Palmerston, the famous Prime Minister of yesteryear, when he was on his deathbed, said to his doctor, "Die, my dear doctor. That's the last thing I shall do." No, it's not. It is appointed unto man once to die, and after that, the judgment. That's the last thing that we will experience and do. So we need to recognize that judgment is fair. Judgment is just. Judgment will come if people reject the gospel and reject Jesus. There's one other thing we need to glean from this story concerning winning the victory in our lives. And that is, we need to get our priorities into place. We need to understand that real life is worth more than things. The interesting thing, I don't know if you noticed it, was that when the decree went out, when the king gave Mordecai the permission to send out the second decree, he gave them permission to defend themselves and to take the plunder from the houses of anybody who attacked them. That was what the second decree said. But three times in this chapter, it says that the Jews did not touch the plunder. They didn't seize the material things that were available to them. They had their priorities right. Rescue, life, that was all that was important. Accumulating more things was not even in their heads. What a lesson, what a challenge that is for us at Christmas, isn't it? When we're accumulating more rubbish we don't need. How many boxes of toiletries are stuck away in the back of your cupboards that come out at the next sale of work because you don't want them? And yet you get more and more. It goes on and on, doesn't it? We're going to claim the victory that God has won for us. We need to get things balanced in our lives. We need to get things right. We need to know what's seriously important. And what's seriously important is that you know God, that you have Jesus in your life, that you have your sins forgiven, that you have peace with God, that you have the hope that He alone can give to us. You've heard the story of the wee boy that had his hand stuck in an expensive vase, and the parents pled with him to pull his hand out, but he would not pull his hand out because it was stuck. Eventually, the only solution was to smash this seriously expensive vase. And of course, what he was doing was clutching the penny he'd seen at the bottom of the vase. A penny. And it destroyed the vase. Get your priorities right. What's important? The victory must be won. So don't forget there's an enemy out there. Don't forget to give that enemy the offer of God's grace. But don't forget to also give him a clear warning of the judgment of God that will be his or hers if they refuse the gospel, and recognize the importance of getting priorities right. So the victory was won. When the victory is won in a person's life, it needs to be celebrated. We need to celebrate the victory that God gives. And from verse 18 down to the end, to the end of chapter 10, the whole theme is on the celebration of the victory that God's people win in this story. That's what we're going to do in a moment. Celebrate a victory. Jesus said, "This do in remembrance of me." Celebrate what I've done. The Feast of Purim is instituted here to celebrate the victory that was won on that day. So let's tease out one or two things here that are here for a challenge for us. First of all, it's very plain that if we're going to celebrate the victory, we need to remember that God turns our mourning into joy. Did you notice that wonderful verse in verse 22? As the time when the Jews got relief from their enemies, and as the month when their sorrow was turned into joy and their mourning into a day of celebration. That's why we need to celebrate the victory. God turns our mourning into joy. In a moment, you're turned from a miserable, pathetic, guilt-ridden, shame-filled, sinful person into someone who's forgiven, someone who's free, someone who knows God, somebody who's got hope, who's got peace with God, and who has joy in their lives. God turns our mourning into joy. That's one good reason to celebrate. Second good reason to celebrate is we need to remember that God is always in charge. It's very interesting that in this story, when they decided to celebrate this feast and to celebrate it every year thereafter forever, they called the feast of Purim. Now, Pur, as we know, is the word for lot, for casting a lot, casting dice. And you remember way back in the story, the king and Haman when they plotted against God's people, cast the lot to find the best day for that to happen. And we discovered at that time the wonderful verse in Proverbs that the king casts the lot, but God controls the dice. And it's wonderful that they should choose that name for their celebration, to remind themselves that it's not down to chance. It's actually down to God who controls the chance. It's God who is absolutely, completely in control. But it's no fluke that the 13th day of the 12th month was chosen 11 months hence. It was God who did that, so that everything would happen just as God planned and as God took place. We see that again and again in the story of Jesus, don't we? God in control. No, I can't do that yet. It's not my time. That hour's not come yet. Jesus says that again and again. And then the day comes when he says, it's now the time. The time when it was the Passover. Time when the Passover lamb, Jesus, could die at the Passover for us. The time that Jesus could be taken and put to death as the sacrificial lamb in the very place where Abraham had tried to sacrifice Isaac. And where Abraham had said, God himself will provide a lamb. And there it is in that place, in the wonderful overall charge of God. And I never for a minute think that God is not in charge. Vance Havner said, this is the victory that overcomes the world when we are shipwrecked on God and stranded on his omnipotence, on his power. Claim the victory because God is always in charge. Claim the victory because his eye is always on his people. You see, the 10th chapter ends by telling us Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Xerxes, preeminent among the Jews, and held in high esteem by his many fellow Jews because he worked for the good of his people and spoke up for the welfare of all the Jews. And that sums up the way God had brought about this amazing victory. Queen Esther won the beauty contest. She became the queen. God's person in the right place at the right time. Just as Mordecai reminded her, Esther, who knows, but you've come to the kingdom for just such a time as this. Then Mordecai one day out in the market overhears the plot to kill the king and sends the message, and it seems forgotten. And a few years later, when the king couldn't sleep at night, he reads about that in his book of Chronicles, and it wonderfully all timed out that Haman would be exposed. God's eye never for a minute left his people. Always working towards it. And so Mordecai becomes second in the kingdom. Like Joseph did, didn't he? Like Nehemiah did, didn't he? Like Daniel did, didn't he? God's eye on his people again and again. Remember that God's eye is always on his people. And remember the whole business with joy. Words like joy, feasting, celebration pop up again and again in this chapter. The victory was to be celebrated. The enemy was dead. The plot had been foiled. God's people were established in a position of power. It was all worth celebrating. And so they were to have a feast, and they were to share food with one another, and they weren't to forget the poor. Like, we shouldn't forget the poor at Christmas time either, and that should be worked in to our celebration and our giving of things. But there they were. They were to celebrate and rejoice in the whole business. Like we will do. Yes, the communion is a time for thinking. It's a time for remembering our sin. It's a time for repenting again. But it's also a time for re-engaging with Jesus and claiming his victory and then celebrating that in our lives and in our hearts. It's to be celebrated with joy. Joy is the echo of God's life within us, someone said. Joy is to behold God in everything, somebody said. Joy is that deep, settled confidence that God is in control of every aspect of my life. Celebrate then with joy. And finally, celebrate this victory by remembering that God has given us peace. Mordecai sends out a letter at the end of chapter 9. It's a celebrating, it's a letter rather, filled with words, we're told there in verse 30, of goodwill and assurance. You can relax. Peace is yours. The problem solved. The enemy's dead. Peace with God is now yours. Paul writes, if we are justified by faith, we have peace with God. That's the great gift of the victory that God wins for us with Jesus on the cross. It's peace with God. He can be at peace with God. You're right with God now. You have no fear for the future or for death or judgment. We need then to celebrate this victory. And we will do that in a moment.